Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Use the word theology a lot. Throw that word around a lot, used in a lot of churches. The breakdown of the word theology comes from the Greek word theos. Theos means God. You're familiar with logos. Logos, translated word in the New Testament. It also has a deeper meaning, though. It really means intelligence demonstrated by spoken word. In other words, there is a mind and intelligence, a God up there, and intelligence over all of creation that is demonstrated by his word and in his word. The word logia, the Greek word logia is actually theos, logia. This has to do with words about a subject. It's the basis whenever you see ology at the end of any word, whether it's biology or whether it's systematics. If you're doing your systematics reading about theology and God, you can read about pneumatology, the study of the Holy Spirit, or Christology, the study of Christ. The ology part of it, coming from the logia, means study of or words about a particular topic. But we throw the word theology around as if it is a catchphrase for all of the above, whether we're talking about pneumatology or soteriology or Christology or any of the ologies that have to do with the Bible. They all come under the general heading of theology. One of the most difficult things to do, though, is to find a good, concise statement that defines your theos logia. What do you say? What are the good words about God? What are the words that you use to define what you believe about God? And most folks, if you ask them simply, what do you think about God, what do you believe about God, they'll have a real difficult time defining it for you. Most folks don't know what they believe about God, which is why I am such a hard-headed old man when it comes to doctrine and theology, because it doesn't just matter that you believe about God, it matters what you believe about God. There are a lot of folks out there who think, I believe in God, and therefore that's satisfactory. But it's not. It's not satisfactory to just believe in God or to believe that God exists. As James says, the devil believes that God exists. The demons all believe that God exists, and they tremble. Believe me when I tell you that everybody who goes to hell will believe that God exists, because he will be the one that sends them there. There won't be any question in their mind that God exists. What you believe about God is very, very important. And what we here at GCA promote as our theology, what we believe about God, is standard, historic, evangelical theology that has disappeared by and large from the church world. I say all this because I was accused this week via email of promoting a new idea, this new, people who hear about God's absolute sovereignty and predestinary will and his absolute ability to elect whom he will and everything. There are folks out there to whom that is such a shock, because they're so unfamiliar with their scripture and with their Bible, that they're just so shocked to hear anybody promote such an idea that, for lack of knowing what else to say, they say, well, that's a new thing. You're promoting some new thing. This book, I'm going to read from for just a second. This is Debating Calvinism. It's James White's latest book. It's actually James White and Dave Hunt, although Dave Hunt ends up adding what amounts to interstitial material. But I'm going to read from chapter 1 here a paragraph that is from the 1689 Baptist Confession of Faith. And this is the Baptist Confession of Faith in modern English. And I have never found a more concise, exact, perfect description of my theology, the words that I believe about God. If you want to know, what does Jim believe about God, I'm going to tell you. And I'm going to tell you that, fortunately, a bunch of guys got together back in 1689 in London and sat down and said, let's spell out what Jim believes about God. And they wrote it down 300 and something years ago. They sat down and defined what the standard Baptist theology, the words about God, are. And see if you can find me a standard Baptist church anywhere that believes what I'm about to read to you. And yet this is what once upon a time was Standard Baptist theology. And then I'm going to read the paragraph after it, where James White comments on it, for two reasons. Number one, so I can say one more time, this is what I believe. If you want to know what I believe, this is it. And secondly, to show you that what we promote here has been around for a long time. This is not new. This is standard evangelical theology that has largely disappeared, and the gospel of God's sovereign grace has been lost on a church world that has just become more modern and likes a more manageable God. So here we go. God is all sufficient, and all life, all glory, goodness, and blessedness are found in him and in him alone. I agree with every word of that. He does not stand in need of any of the creatures he has made. Isn't that kind of shocking to our modern sensibilities? He does not stand in need of any of the creatures he has made. Nor does he derive any part of his glory from them. All glory resides in him. They are glorified by being part of him, but he does not derive his glory from them. On the contrary, he manifests his own glory in and by them. He is the fountainhead of all being and the origin, channel, and end of all things. He is the beginning and the end of all things, and the channel through which all things happen. Over all of his creatures, he is sovereign. He uses them as he pleases. Did you catch that? He is sovereign over his creatures, therefore, he uses them as he pleases. They are there to glorify him. He uses them as he pleases and does for them and does to them all that he wills. Do you know that that's completely and utterly biblical? But it's shocking to our modern sensibilities. What, a God who does whatever he wants to people? Yeah, it's exactly what I believe. His knowledge is infinite and infallible. His knowledge of everything is unmistaken. He knows everything and he knows it perfectly. No single thing is to him at risk or uncertain, for he is not dependent upon created things. He's not dependent on the things he created to show him anything. He's not waiting around wringing his great eternal hands wondering what's going to happen. He has decreed the end from the beginning. In his decisions, his doings, and his demands, he is most holy. In all his decisions, in all his doing, and his demands. You know, it turns out that sometimes God just demands things of people, and he's absolutely righteous and holy when he does it. Which makes me think of Daniel when Nebuchadnezzar said, "Who can stop God's hand?" or say to him, "What are you doing?" Angels and men owe to God, as their creator, all worship, service, and obedience, and whatever else he may require at their hands. Isn't that a remarkable statement? You would think that all worship, service, and obedience would have covered it. But they were wise enough to know that worship, service, obedience, and whatever else he requires is what Paul would call your just service. That's what you ought to do, your service to God, whatever it is he requires of you. So James White picks up and writes, "Thus the 1689 Baptist Confession of Faith describes the great foundational truths of the biblical revelation of God. God is the creator, and therefore he is king over everything he has made. The king rules over his creation. This is the divine truth of God's sovereignty, his right to rule over what he has made. Those who love their king and are subject to him find his sovereignty a great comfort and delight.
those who are in rebellion against him fight and chafe against that divine truth. Much can be determined concerning our true subjection to God by asking if, in fact, we love God as he has revealed himself to be. Did you catch that? I'm going to read it again in case you didn't catch the question. Much can be determined concerning our true subjection to God by asking if, in fact, we love God as he has revealed himself to be. See, many folks have a God of their own imagination, which even Paul talked about, that there were folks who came into the Galatian church who preached another Christ. They preached another faith. Paul would argue that it was not another gospel and another Christ. And he said it's not another. And the word that he used in the Greek was, it's not commensurate with. It's not the same thing. It's in fact different. It's a lesser thing. Because people just can't, by and large, deal with the real God of the real Bible who really defines himself as being absolutely sovereign over everything. So what do people do? Well, they rub against it. They chafe against it. They don't like it. They argue with it. They fight back. Or as he said, we should love God as he has revealed himself to be the divine ruler over all things. Or we should ask ourselves whether we seek to edit God down to a more manageable and manlike deity. And that's what so much of what is passing for theology today is doing. They're calling it theology and then going about redefining God into more manageable terms, into a God that they can deal with, into a God that is more seeker-sensitive, into a God that is going to be more likable by the world. And so they clip off all those rough edges of God or all those sort of thorny issues that would make people go, ooh, my ego and my flesh doesn't like that. A God who chooses what he wants and does what he wants, I can't handle that. Therefore, give me a God who's more palatable. Give me a God who's friendlier. Give me a God who does what I want him to do, who will serve me on a regular basis if I tip him on Sunday. Give me a God who will make sure that I get everything I want and I'll be healthy and wealthy and prosperous. Give me that God. But don't give me that God of the Bible. Well, friends, there's only one God, and that one God has revealed himself one way. And in the Bible, he has revealed himself as deriving absolutely no glory from you whatsoever. In fact, he is encased in all glory, has glorified himself in the infinite light that no man can approach. And if you, at some point in eternity future, manage to stand before that God without frying, it's for one reason and one reason only. His grace, his sovereignty, and his decision to choose you. Because you were incapable of getting to him. And that is biblical theology. But I'm not hearing that theology anywhere. So I was very glad to see that in James's book. Of course, I could count on James to say something like that. And I'll stand up here and say it and say it and say it, and people will just have to keep sending me emails. And they're going to keep saying, what is this you're saying? Well, it's what the Bible says. But man, folks don't like that. Turn to Numbers 11. We are talking about manna. What does manna mean?
What is it?
What is it? That's exactly what it means. They walked out, they saw it on the ground, and they said, manna, what is it? And God began feeding them with manna a month and a half after they were out of Egypt. He suffered them to hunger for a while so that they would look to him, and then he fed them with manna. Now, the thing about God's miraculous provision, and we talked at some length last week about the fact that God has only ever promised you two things. He's promised you food and raiment. Food and raiment. He made sure that for 40 years, as the Israelites wandered in the wilderness, that for that 40 years, their clothes didn't wear out, the leather of their sandals didn't wear out, and he gave them food every single day. You've got food, you've got raiment, they should have been satisfied. That's all your promise, food and raiment, and he gave it to them every single day, miraculously. So what did they do? Like all of us, they reached the point where they said, you know, I'm really tired of all this miraculous provision. I'm really tired of this light bread. I grow weary of eating the same thing every day, even though God himself is feeding me every single day. I've grown weary of that. I prefer something different, thank you. So they begin to murmur and complain. Turns out that God, the same God who is now ruling and reigning in the heavens, doesn't take kindly to it when he provides for his people and they complain about it. There's a lesson here for us. I am in chapter 11 of the book of Numbers, starting at verse 1. And when the people complained, it displeased the Lord. You see the capital L-O-R-D? That's Yahweh. That's that proper name of God, boy. That's that name he pulls out when he says, I am God Almighty. I'm the God over everything. That God. That God was displeased to hear his people complain, which you can only imagine. They were in bondage. They were slaves in Egypt. They cried out for deliverance. God sends them a deliverer, takes them through the Red Sea. They can see the water standing there while a pillar of fire is lighting their way, while a pillar of dark cloud is keeping their enemies back, till the whole group of them, we're talking potentially in the millions, 1 to 3 million people, as they all pass through the Red Sea, they get to the other side. God lifts that cloud, lights the way into the Red Sea. The armies, who they owe all that money and gold and cattle to, all run into the Red Sea. God drowns their debtors, and then God takes them out into the wilderness and feeds them with miraculous food every day, and they complain. You can only imagine that God would go, you know, enough is enough, right? He's displeased. We who are parents, who have children, know how difficult it is to keep the children happy. It doesn't matter how much you shell out, how many things you buy, how many clothes they have, how many toys they have. I used to walk into my children's room and it would just be chock full of toys and stuff and games, Legos and things and Nintendos and dolls and computer and TV in every room. And they would come out and say to me, I'm bored and there's nothing to do. I did not go, I understand, let's go buy more stuff. It made me displeased. It made me go, you know, I'm knocking myself out here. I'm working as hard as I can. Your mother and I are supplying for you like mad. Perhaps thank you would be good. But you never hear that from your kids. You never hear, Mom, Dad, thank you for everything I have. Closet full of clothes. Lots of things to do. You're wonderful. I love you, Mom and Dad. You don't get that. Well, God, like a good father, is listening to these people. He has just provided all this stuff for, and they're complaining. And it displeased him. And the Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled. And the fire of the Lord came down and burnt among them, and it consumed them that were in the uttermost parts of the camp. God looked down on these people complaining, and it so bothered him. Now get a sense of the character of God here. This is still the same God you're dealing with. This is still the same God in heaven. He didn't change over the last 4,000 years. This is still God. And he provided for them, and they complained, and they murmured, and they whined, and he burned them up. Why? Because he's sovereign and can do whatever he wants to his own. They're his own, and for his own glory, and to show his own justice and his own holy righteousness, he can provide for them and he can burn them. And both of them are just as holy in act, because he's a holy God. To us, it's he did what? He burned what? From God's perspective, I am holy, I am righteous, I am God. How dare you not worship me for everything I've done for you? I'll burn you. And he did. That's remarkable. If you don't see the sovereignty of God in that passage, then you don't see the sovereignty of God anywhere. He burned people up. And the people cried unto Moses, and when Moses prayed unto the Lord, the fire was quenched. What do you see there? Intercession. The people had so angered God, and God's wrath was coming down on them in fire, and they were incapable of stopping it. They were the ones who complained. They cried, and it didn't help. They knew enough to go to the intercessor. Go to the one who talks to God. Go to the one who God talks to. Go to the one who can get God's ear. They go to Moses and say, stop it. Moses goes to God, talks to God about it. God stops it. See, the problem with us sinners is that we're so egocentric and so bold that we think that when it goes bad, we have the right to burst into God's presence and explain to him the way it ought to work. That we ought to be able to go to God and say, this is the way I'd prefer to have it, God. But the truth is, you don't have the capacity to go straight to God and start making demands. You got to go to an intercessor. You got to find somebody who's got God's ear. And boy, it's good news to know that we have this intercessor who the book of Hebrews, as Jeff's going to read, it says that he is able to save them to the uttermost that come to God through him, because he ever lives to do what? Make intercession for them. He ever lives to make intercession for us because we continue to be just like these people, whining, complaining, not happy, not ready to serve him in everything that he requires of us. And it's really good that we can go to our Lord, to our elder brother, that we can go to Christ and say, you know, God by all rights ought to be burning me down right now. I couldn't be more wrong. And it's good to know that we've got an intercessor that ever lives to make that kind of intercession and go to God one more time on our behalf and say, I paid for him. I own him. I'm here to intercede for him. Yes, right, he's a sinner, but I paid for those sins. And God casts those sins as far as the east is from the west, does not impute that sin to you, and you don't burn. But God's perfectly willing to burn. Gonna burn, gonna put a whole lot of people in hell. But some people get interceded for. Man, there's the gospel way back there in Numbers that you need an intercessor. So he prayed unto the Lord and the fire was quenched. And so he called the name of that place Taberah because the fire of the Lord burnt among them. And the mixed multitude that was among them fell into lusting. Some of your translations there in verse 4. What else have you got? Have you got like rabble or foreigners or... foreigners? What? Rabble. Yeah. When God delivered the slaves out of Egypt, there were some non-Israelite slaves. And when the slaves were delivered, they went. That's who this is talking about, the mixed multitude, the non-Israelite multitude that was traveling with them, that had no great love or affection or connection to the God of Israel. They didn't have the history with Abraham. They didn't have circumcision. They weren't, but they were there traveling with them. And so they start lusting. In other words, their flesh wanted more than they were getting. Now they were traveling, these people too, through the Red Sea, getting fed every day with manna, traveling with the Israelites. But they're the ones who, right away, the ones outside the camp, the ones who were not really part of the revealed religion of God. Those people are on the periphery, who start coming in and talking about what God should do and ought to do and God ought to, those are always the people you got to watch for. Coming in from the outside and telling you how you ought to think about God. They came in lusting and the children of Israel started weeping again. See the difference? The mixed multitude and the children of Israel, two different groups. So they come in and start complaining to the point where the Israelites go, yeah, hey, yeah, you're right. Hadn't thought of that. Good point. So they all start craving flesh. Who shall give us flesh to eat? This light bread is not good enough. Verse 5, we remember the fish, and we did eat in Egypt freely, and the cucumbers, and the melons, and the leeks, and the onions, and the garlic. They were slaves, by the way, making bricks out in the hot sun. And when Moses came around, they cut back, you know, on the amount of straw they could use to make bricks, and yet they had to double up their... Do you think they really ate freely of all the fish and leeks and onions and cucumber they wanted? No. But man, we like to romanticize the way it used to be, don't we? I was happier then. You were a slave! You were working in the hot sun, you had nothing. Yeah, but we ate fish every once in a while, and as I remember it, we ate it freely whenever we wanted. No, your captors fed you to keep you strong enough to keep doing their work. You were not eating freely. But that's the way they remembered it. But now our soul is dried away. Oh. And there is nothing at all, nothing at all. There is nothing to eat. There is nothing at all, oh, besides this manna before our eyes. There's only the provision of God and what he wants for us. That's all there is. There's only the miraculous provision of God that comes every morning on the ground that we eat every day. There's only that, and I'm not happy. As a group, they're all unhappy that God has provided for them every day. Should I apply this? How many of you have in the back, they're going, no, don't apply it. When was the last time you stood in front of a refrigerator full of food and said, there's nothing to eat? Or touched a nerve. Or stood in a closet full of clothes and said, I have nothing to wear. Or stood in your air-conditioned home and said, I'm not comfortable. Hit another nerve. I'm not happy. Drive in your car, your air-conditioned car, saying, my car's old. That's a good car. I like that car. Look, you have in your life at this particular moment, you may now apply it freely to your life. You get the drift. You have in your life right at this moment precisely and exactly what God has determined for you, in the amount that God has determined you would have it at this moment. And again, we are a blessed, blessed people with a phenomenal abundance of food and clothing, houses, cars, this nice building to meet in. Who are we to ever, ever complain, ever? And so here they are, whining away. There's nothing before our eyes but this miraculous provision of God, and it's not good enough. I want something more. The manna was as coriander seed, verse 7 says, and the color thereof was as the color of delium. Who else? What else have you got there? Like an off-white? What do you got?
Resin.
Like a resin color? Yeah. The people went out and they gathered it and they ground it in mills, or they beat it with a mortar, and they baked it in pans, and they made cakes out of it, and the taste of it was like the taste of fresh oil. In other words, they tried every way they could to prepare it, because they only had one thing to eat. So they prepared it, they boiled it, they fried it, they chopped it, they mortared it, they did everything they could to it to create some variety. And when the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell upon it. And Moses heard the people weeping throughout the families, every man in the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly, and Moses also was displeased. Every man at the door of his tent. Can you imagine that? You know, that phrase, misery loves company, is true. You can go along, go along, go along in your life and feel pretty content. And contentment's hard. Contentment's difficult. I admit that. It's very hard to be content with your lot in life, regardless of what your lot in life is. Believe me, as we speak, Bill Gates is trying to get more money. Trump's trying to turn yet another deal. Contentment is very, very hard for human beings. But nothing is tougher than for us to be in the presence of another malcontent. This is just human nature. I'm talking psychology now. But if Tom and I are hanging out together, and I've been in a pretty good mood, but when I get together with Tom, he starts grousing about his life and how things are going and what he's not happy about, will I pull Tom up to my contentment, or will he pull me down to his malcontentment? Which way will it go? You know. Down. We'll gravitate down. Sure we will. And when I get done talking to Tom about his malcontentment, I'll get on the phone and tell somebody else about Tom's malcontentment. You won't believe Tom. Man, Tom, he couldn't. Oh, man. He's got it rough. It's going bad for him. And then he said blah, blah, blah. And then it just spreads. That's what happened in Israel. The outsiders, the foreigners, started with, this isn't good enough. Next thing you know, people within Israel are going, yeah, you're right, this isn't good enough. Then it ends up every man in the doorway of his tent standing there saying, I couldn't be less happy about this. This miraculous provision of God every day. Well, it's no wonder God and Moses are upset. Same God, by the way. Same God who hears every word you say. Same God who's fully aware of whether you're content with his provision or not. Same God who knows how much he's blessed you, how much he's given you, how much he's provided for you. And he's there and he's listening. He's waiting to hear thank you. He's waiting to hear blessed is God in everything he does. He's waiting to hear us sing his praises. And 99% of the time he hears unhappiness, discontent and anger and we're not happy and I need more and why haven't you and why didn't you do more and what have you done for me lately? So they were all in the tent, and the anger of the Lord was greatly kindled. Moses said unto the Lord, why have you afflicted me, your servant? And wherefore have I not found favor in your sight, that you lay the burden of all these people upon me? Now even Moses is unhappy. Now Moses reaches the point of going to God and saying, I can't handle these people. What do you want from me? Look at his argument. It's a great argument. Verse 12. Did I give birth to all these people? Did I conceive all these people? This is not my doing, this is your doing. Have I begotten them that you should say unto me, carry them in your bosom as a nursing father bearing a sucking child? I can't take care of all these people. I can't mother all these people. I didn't bear them. I didn't give them birth. And yet I have the burden of all these people. And should I take them unto the land that you swore to their fathers? Where am I going to give all these people flesh to eat? For they weep unto me, saying, give us flesh that we may eat. I'm not able to bear all these people alone, because it is too heavy for me. And it was. Can you imagine responsibility for, again, like I said, 1 million to 3 million people, all whining and complaining at you every time something goes wrong, as a group, coming at you like you're the one that brought them out in the wilderness? It's no wonder Moses was ready to break. Enough. He goes to God and says, enough. I'm not able to bear it. I can't take any more of this. And if you deal this way with me, then just kill me, I pray. If this is the way it's going to be, then kill me. Kill me, I pray thee, out of hand. If I have found favor in your sight. Look what he's saying. If you really love me, kill me, because I can't take any more of this. These people are too much for me. Can you hear the sadness in this man? Can you feel the burden that this man was carrying? Let me not see my own wretchedness, is the last phrase. He can't live anymore with his state. So just kill me, God. The Lord said unto Moses, gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be elders of the people and officers over them. Bring them unto the tabernacle of the congregation, that they may stand there with thee. And I will come down, and I will talk with you there. And I will take the spirit that is upon you, and I will put it upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, so that you will not have to bear it alone. God agrees with him and says, okay, go get 70 men. This is the beginning, actually, the beginning of the structure of what's going to become the judges in Israel, which later, after you get through the Pentateuch, the next book that you get into is the Judges, the time of the Judges after Moses and Joshua are gone, men who are going to judge over Israel. This is the beginning of that. And he says, I'll come down and talk to them and put the spirit that's on you on them. Say unto the people, verse 18, say this to the people, sanctify yourselves against tomorrow, and you will eat flesh. For you have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, who shall give us flesh to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you flesh to eat, and you shall eat. And you shall not eat one day, or 2 days, or 5 days, or 10 days, or 20 days, but for a whole month you're going to eat meat until it's coming out your nostrils. See that phrase? God says, oh, you want what you want? How about I give you what you want to the point where it makes you sick? There's an object lesson to be had here. Even a whole month until it's coming out your nostrils, until the meat is loathsome to you, because that you have despised the Lord which is among you, and you have wept before him, saying, why did he bring us out of Egypt? See, you got to be really careful here, friends. You got to be careful what you tell God you want, because he might give it to you. And he knows that it's not good for you. And he knows it's not right for you, but he also knows the only way you're going to learn it. It's the hard way. It's very much like, going back to kids, when you say, don't touch that, it's hot. Don't touch that, it's hot. A good parent will eventually go, all right, go ahead and touch it. And they go over and they touch it and their hand gets, whoa, that's hot. And you go, exactly, that's what I was telling you. They want to touch it so bad, you finally say, well, all right, it's going to hurt. Go ahead, go on, hurt yourself. And then they won't do it anymore. And in fact, they'll listen to you the next time when you say, don't touch it, it's hot. They go, oh, well, you know, last time they were right. It was really hot. I guess I won't touch that this time. That's all part of parenting. Now, somebody out there is going to say, Jim said that good parents burn their children. That's not what I said. It's not what I said. I said, sometimes children only learn by hard object lessons that come from giving them what they want. I'll make a better example. I don't want dinner. I just want ice cream and cookies. A willing participant. Sometimes the parent will go, fair enough, ice cream and cookies. There you go, ice cream and cookies, ice cream and cookies. So they go, man, my belly hurts. Exactly. It's not good to just eat ice cream and cookies. And they get that lesson. When I was young, we had friends that came over to the house sometimes who smoked, so I became fascinated with smoking. I guess I was 12. So, oh, smoking, that looks kind of cool. Look at the way they light up, and they got that thing hanging out the side of their lip. You know, ooh. And so my dad, you know, took a couple cigarettes from our friend and said, here you go, light up. And my dad said, now, the important thing about smoking is, you see it coming, don't you? To really enjoy it and to get the full benefit of it. You got to breathe real deep, you know. Suck the smoke in and then just breathe it into your lungs, you know. You'll really dig it. It's going to be great. Like my dad would ever say, dig it. But you're really gonna like it. You know, it's going to be good. And so, sure, boy, we lit that thing up. I think it was a Winston back then. You know, light that thing up and I coughed for a week and a half. I never went back to a cigarette again in my life. I said, these things are not good. These things will kill you. But see, cigarettes, by the way, are a great example, a great visual example of sin and the way sin works. I don't care what your sin is, whatever your pet favorite sin is, the first time you get involved with it, you know it's wrong and you don't like it and it hurts you and it feels bad. But, you know, if you smoke 2 or 3 cigarettes and then 2 or 3 packs, after a while, your body acclimates to it. Same thing with sin. You go back to your sin with any regularity. After a while, it doesn't seem that bad. It doesn't seem that sinful. Gee, I'm doing it. I'm getting away with it. God hasn't fried me. I guess I'm getting away with it okay. So you just keep participating in that sin. And then smoking becomes a habit because the nicotine in the cigarette is in there on purpose, marketing through chemistry. And they'll keep bringing you back for more and more because you're now addicted to the cigarette the same way that you're addicted to that sin that you knew the first time you did it was wrong. You know what I mean? The first time that you walk into, you know, the bar and sit down and say, I think I'll have a drink. Gee, this is kind of a dark, not very good environment and it's, you know, 1 in the morning, but here I am. You know you're not supposed to be there. You can look around and say, I don't belong here. I'm a Christian person. I profess God. I don't belong here. I'll just have one drink. And you have your one drink and you go home. But the next time you drive by, you go, well, I know what's in that building now. And it wasn't that bad. And I had a drink. I'll drop by and I'll have a drink. And you go and you have 8 drinks. And you drive home kind of, whoa. Next thing you know, that's part of your life. You're going by there every happy hour and stopping in every night and everything. Because you let yourself, you allowed yourself to become acclimated to the thing you knew was bad for you to start with. That's the way human beings work. That's exactly what happened to Israel here. That's my point, now that I've applied it to all of us, is that they started with, you know, we're not happy, we're not happy, I want what I want. God finally will say, really, do you want it? You know, one of the arguments that people use against the sovereignty of God is that they use God's sovereignty as an excuse for the way they are. Know what I'm talking about? People who say, well, sure, I fill in the blank. Find some bad thing people do. Sure, I do this and I shouldn't, whatever it is. But if God's sovereign, he'd have stopped me if he didn't want me to do it. And they use that as their excuse for being that way. God made me this way and God doesn't make mistakes. Therefore, I'm not responsible for the way I'm being. Which Paul talked about in Romans when he said, should we sin all the more that grace may abound? No, absolutely not. God forbid. That's not the way it works. But I have heard person after person after person in my life say, well, this is just the way God made me, and you're the one who says he's sovereign, and if he made me this way, then it's not my fault, that's the way he made me. No, what that is God allowing you and your stupid flesh to have what you and your stupid flesh want to prove the point that you have no idea what's good for you or what's right for you, but he's going to let you learn it the hard way by giving you the very thing you want.
And the people that say, well, I'm saved anyway, so.
Yeah, I'm saved anyway, it's all under the blood, doesn't matter. Oh, well, wasn't it Jesus who said, you will not tempt the Lord your God? There's no difference between that kind of thinking and throwing yourself in front of a bus to say, I can't die until God decides I die. You know, God may have decided that's the time you die because you're that stupid. You know, there, you're dead. You don't tempt the Lord your God. The devil did that. That's the devil's thinking. The devil said to Jesus, throw yourself off this pinnacle. Took him to a high pinnacle and said, throw yourself off because the angels will bear you up because it's written, and quoted scripture to him, because it's written that his angels will bear you up so you won't dash your foot against a rock. No, that's exactly right. That's the way we think. Yeah. Get our religion so twisted around that we demand of God the way we think he's going to do it. He does it the way he chooses to do it. So, God predicts, not only am I going to give you what you want, I'm going to give you so much of it that you're going to get sick on it. It's going to come out your nostrils. You're going to learn to hate the thing you want. Because God, as a good, faithful father, is going to teach you, if you belong to him, he's going to teach you to hate what you want. But you don't want what you want. You want what God wants, because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. He knows what's going to happen tomorrow. So God's going to give them exactly what they want until it makes them sick. Verse 21, Moses said, the people among whom I am are 600,000 footmen alone, and thou hast said, I will give them flesh that they may eat a whole month. Now, that's just the footmen, the general guys who can go out and do some labor, go out and do some work. And that's 600,000. So that means by the time you put wives for those guys, and you put the old people in, and you put the children in, you're talking about a huge number of people. He says, where in the world are we going to get enough flesh to feed all them for a whole month? Shall the flocks and the herds all be slain for them? And would that even suffice? Or shall all the flesh of the sea be gathered together for them to suffice them? And the Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's hand waxed short? In other words, one more time, Moses says, wait. You want me to go tell them that they're going to have flesh to the plenty till it's coming out their nostrils for a whole month? Where are we going to get that kind of food? God's answer is, I'm God. Is God's hand too short to accomplish the thing God says he's going to do? God himself argues his own sovereignty. God himself resorts back to his sovereignty as God. I control everything. That's the answer. Verse 24. Well, the second half of 23. The Lord said unto Moses, is the Lord's hand waxed short? You will see now whether my word shall come to pass unto thee or not. In other words, I'm not going to do this through Moses. Moses said, what shall we do? What are we going to do? Are we going to kill the flocks? Are we going to fish out the sea until we get all the fish? What are we going to do to feed these people? And he said, no, you still don't get it. I'm going to do all this. And I'm going to do it without you, Moses. I'm God. I'm going to do it. Stand aside and you watch me do it. Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord. And he gathered 70 men of the elders of the people, and he set them round about the tabernacle. And the Lord came down in a cloud, and he spoke unto Moses. And he took the spirit that was upon Moses and gave it to the 70 elders. And it came to pass that when the spirit rested upon them, that they prophesied and did not cease. But there remained two of the men in the camp. And the name of the one was Eldad, the name of the other was Medad. And the spirit rested upon them, and they were of them that were written, but they were not out unto the tabernacle, and they prophesied inside the camp. And there ran a young man, and he told Moses, and said, Eldad and Medad do prophesy in the camp. Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of Moses, one of his young men, answered and said, my lord Moses, forbid them from doing this. Moses said unto him, do you envy for my sake? I would to God that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his spirit upon all of them. And Moses got him into the camp, he and the elders of Israel. Now what that little story, that little parenthetical story thrown in there about, is that Moses picked the 70 elders. Their names were written down apparently by God or by Moses. And when they were told to come and gather around the tabernacle, apparently 68 of them actually made it out to the tabernacle. Two of them were still in the camp. But when the spirit that was on Moses was given to the 70, God was faithful to give it to these two, even though they hadn't made it to the tabernacle, because they had been chosen to have it. And where they were didn't change it. And so they were all out there by the tabernacle, the 68 of them, plus Moses, plus Joshua. They're out there at the tabernacle, and they're all prophesying and speaking about God. And then the two who didn't make it are still in the camp, and they start prophesying about God. And typical human flesh, when it was heard that these two guys who didn't make it to the tabernacle got the same blessing, they go to Moses and say, oh, tell these guys to stop. Moses said, I would that everybody had the Spirit and that everybody. I've said all the time, people ask about preaching and preachers and whether preachers are competitive. I wish that there was a man on every street corner in America preaching the grace of God. I'm not afraid of competition. I wish that there was preachers absolutely everywhere proclaiming the gospel of God's sovereign grace. Moses had that same attitude. It was the right attitude. He said, no, I wish everybody knew the truth of God and was telling it. Verse 31. So here's what happened. We're nearly done. Verse 31. There went forth a wind from God, and it brought quails in from the sea. And it let them fall by the camp, as it were a day's journey on this side, and as it were a day's journey on the other side, round about the camp, and as it were 2 cubits high upon the face of the earth. Can you picture that? Talk about a camp that has a couple million people in it. That's a big camp. That's a large encampment. From all the way around the circumference of that camp, a day's journey in any direction, so many quail that they're 2 cubits deep. Do you realize how many birds that is? Quail are not big birds. Have you seen quail? They're not large birds. And a day's journey in every direction you go from the camp, 2 cubits deep, quail. And God did it. He brought them in on a wind, brings them in from all directions to the camp, and then kills them dead, and they all drop on the ground all the way around the camp. There is miraculous provision. So now the people got what they wanted. You get that? They weren't happy with what God provided. They complained about what they had. They wanted more. They wanted something different. They wanted what they wanted. Now God has not just given them what they want. He's given them an overabundance of what they want, piles and piles of what they want. You would think then, and certainly by all modern notions of God, if you go pray to God for what you want, what you want, what you want, and he gives it to you, that's a blessing. It is not a blessing to these people. It is, in fact, a curse to these people that God gives them precisely what they want. Again, be careful what you ask God for, because he just might give it to you. Not to bless you, but to teach you a hard lesson. So verse 32, and the people stood up all day, and they stood up all night, and all the next day. These people just stayed awake all day and night gathering birds. They were so excited. Look at all the birds. We got to collect them before they rot. Let's go get the food, the food, the food. And they gathered the quails. He that gathered the least gathered 10 homers. Now, I don't know what a homer is, but what else do you have? Is there a measurement in any of your Bibles?
It says 60 bushels.
60 bushels. Okay, the people who gathered the least amount gathered 60 bushels. That's a bunch of birds. He that gathered least gathered 10 homers, and they spread them all abroad for themselves round about the camp. Look at verse 33. They're so excited. We have a month's worth of meat now. We've got tons and tons of birds now. Let's eat. A month. They're thinking, we got a month's worth of this. We don't have to eat manna for a month. No manna for us. We've got birds to eat for a month. And as soon as they eat it, verse 33, while the flesh was yet between their teeth, before it was chewed, they didn't even get the joy of crunching into it. Well, they set it in their mouth, and before they get the chance to chew it, the wrath of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord killed the people with a very great plague. You see it? I want what I want when I want it, and I'm going to go to God and demand it. And if God doesn't give it to me, I'm going to whine and I'm going to complain and I'm not going to be content and I'm not going to be happy with everything he has provided for me. And I'm going to complain and complain and complain. And then God finally says, okay, enough of your complaining. I'm going to give you what you want. He gives them what they want, a month's worth of what they want. They're so happy they get the first bite. And before they chew it, he kills them with a plague. Isn't that remarkable? That's the God you're dealing with. Now understand me. God has not changed in the last 4,000 years. Same exact God. Get your theology straight. Same exact God has provided for you food and raiment. And cars and homes. Loved ones, people to take care of you. The highest quality available fast food in the history of the world. It's true. We laugh about it, but you know, you drive through McDonald's today, you're picking up whatever. You know, pick your drive-through, Sonic. You go there, you're still buying the highest quality, safest food in the history of the world. It may not always taste that great. But when was the last time any of you got sick on food you bought at a drive-through? I mean, for the most part, the percentage of high-quality food out there is incredibly high. U.S. Department of Agriculture has done a really good job of making sure that we've got lots and lots and lots of really good, really safe food. And you've got enough money in your pocket right now to go get you some. And we'll whine and we'll complain. And then God might very well give you what it is you want in your discontentment. But he's not giving it to you as a blessing. We go, oh boy, I got what I wanted from God. I must be blessed. No, 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 not necessarily. God might be giving you what you want to show you that you don't want what you want. That you got to trust him to give you what you need. You've got to trust him to supply for you the things that will get you from here to eternity. And in between, whatever he gives you is exactly what he decided you should have at this moment. Because that's what glorifies him. He's not in the business of glorifying you. He's not here to be your great eternal waiter and servant. He's here to glorify himself. You're here to glorify him. And he will, in that journey, provide for you everything you need. And you ought to be able to be content with that. But man, we're such sinners that there's not a one of us in this room that's content. Not a one of us that is satisfied. Before it was chewed, while it was in their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord smote the people with a very great plague, and he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people that lusted. So what did their lusting get them?
Buried!
Buried! What did their complaining accomplish? Nothing. And was God perfectly willing to miraculously bring them the thing they craved? Yes! All those birds, a day's journey in every side of the camp, that's an unbelievable miracle. And God did that miracle for their destruction. There's no other way to read it. Huh?
The poor birds.
Well, how many things did God use in that? He used the birds, he used the people, he used the foreigners, he used the camp. He used it because it's all at his disposal, it's all his. He does what he wants with and to his own. Didn't we just read that? And in this case, he did exactly what he wanted with and to his own. And he miraculously, don't miss the miracle part, he miraculously destroyed them. Well, then you have to ask yourself, when God took them out into the wilderness, did he know they were going to complain?
Yeah.
Sure. These things were written for our example. He did this stuff with his people, not as a reaction, but Paul's argument was he did it all on purpose to teach us. That we learn from the example of what he did with these people. And Paul uses those examples constantly in his writing, where he goes back and says, the children of Israel, because they did not have faith, God ended up cursing them, taking them into the wilderness, the first generation died, all of that. They did not enter into the promised land, that first generation, because they did not do it with faith. So God took the second generation, their children, in. So Paul constantly uses, Paul who is the, you know, predestinarian, sovereign, electing, God's in all control guy, constantly used the examples of them dealing with God in the Old Testament as examples for the church. God knew they were going to rebel because his knowledge is perfect in all things. And he used their rebellion to glorify himself, which is what he's in the business of doing. And in glorifying himself, use this example for our benefit all these years later to know the kind of God we're dealing with. So what does that ultimately serve? His glory. But did he know that they were going to do it? Sure. Did that stop him from doing it? No, absolutely not, because it glorified him. Right? The people then journeyed from Kibroth-Hattaavah to Hazeroth, and they abode there at Hazeroth. That's the end of that. Next week, we're going to pick up at Numbers 21, because you would think, after all that, you would think, after him giving them the birds and then plaguing them, you would think, after fire coming down and burning people, you would think after that, that the people would go, you know, we really shouldn't complain. We really ought to just kind of get used to, you know, God's provided and that's pretty much it. And yet, you're going to see in Numbers 21:4 that as they continue their journey, the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way and the journey and how hard it was. The people spoke against God and they say to Moses, wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither any water. It's not true that there's no bread. They still have manna every day. And our soul hates this light bread. Even after all that, they go back to Moses again and say, our soul is so sick and tired of the miraculous provision of God that they, even though there's miracle bread on the ground every morning, will say there's no bread. People standing in their closet saying, I have nothing to wear. People standing in front of their full refrigerator saying, there's nothing to eat. People walking out in the driveway and saying, this car isn't new enough or good enough for me. And my soul hates this light bread. How dare God expect me to eat what he wants me to eat every day? Wouldn't you think they'd learn? But they don't learn. And that's going to cause God to one more time put a curse on them, a curse so significant that it's going to typify Christ, and Jesus himself is going to pick it up in John 3 and use it as an example and a predictive messianic example of why Jesus had to come. So this manna thing is very important. It's why I'm taking all these weeks on it. This manna thing is a great big issue. I'm giving you all the Old Testament background, and then we're going to go look at it in the New Testament, and we're going to see that this manna thing is a really important issue with God because it is an example of him providing constantly for his people and how his people remain dissatisfied with God's provision, which is why Paul argues so much in favor of be content, be satisfied. He has promised you food and raiment. You have food and raiment. Calm down. He even goes so far as to say, be content with such things as you have, knowing he has said, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. If you know that God has said, I'll never leave you and forsake you, well then whatever you have right now is what he has decided for you to have right now. He hasn't left, he hasn't forsaken you, he has provided for you exactly what he wants. Therefore, says Paul, be content with such things as you have, because you know he hasn't abandoned you. If he hasn't abandoned you, and he is sovereign, and he is God, then he knows what you have, he knows what you're doing, where you are, your state of health, how much money you have, what's going on in your life. He knows all that, and that is pleasing him. He's pleased that that's where you're at right now. He's satisfied right now. He's getting glory right now out of the fact that that's how your life is going. So then you ought to find contentment in it too, because if it's good enough for God, then it really ought to be good enough for you. But man, we're just not content people by nature, are we? Not happy. All right, you understand that? Questions, comments? I guarantee before the day's out, you're going to whine and complain about something. I think if there's any verse in the Bible that I struggle with the most, it's be content with such things as you have, for he has said, I'll never leave you, I'll never forsake you. Contentment, that's hard.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.